Ele é problema do parlamento.
Estava em educação.
My name is Upam Narang. I am chairing, acting chairperson on behalf of Ms. Candy Tobias, the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Defense. Without much ado, may I first introduce the Minister of Defense, Mr. Comrade Terrell Kota, who is here with us this morning. And I just want us to, before we could start, I'm told that the preparation of the IT is very problematic. If we knew, I would have asked the Defense Force this morning to do that for us, because we seem to be having a few problems. But that will take us a few more minutes. I will only request that the Defense Force here is with or the Department of Defense is here represented by General Fassensack, who is heading it, that's right. And maybe the Minister will take the liberty of allowing the head of delegation to introduce the delegation, then from there we'll ask members to introduce themselves, so as we can deal with the IT in the meantime.
Honourable Minister, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, so if you would allow me, just apologies for the Secretary for Defence, who just returned from Algiers, as well as the Acting Chief of Defence, who will be meeting the Minister a little later at sea with the heads of navies from our side of the region. Our delegation today to make two presentations to the Honourable Members. First of all, it will be on the Defence Reserves. On my immediate left is Major General Roy Anderson, the Chief of Defence Reserves. To his immediate left, Mr. Nick Campbell from the Policy and Planning Division. Brigadier General Peter Kopmotseke, the Director of Medical Reserves in the Office of the Surgeon General. Colonel Debbie Molefe, the Senior Staff Officer Reserves in the Office of General Anderson. Lieutenant Colonel Roy Marais from the Cape, he's our senior reserve representative in the Cape. Right in front of me is Brigadier General Gerard Kamper, he's the Director of Army Reserves in the Army Office of General Schorke. And then Brigadier General Dries de Wit, who will be responsible for the second presentation on the men. That is our delegations, and we honor here to also have Advocate Kabushi and Mr. Otswamu, as well as our parliamentary officers.
Thank you very much. May we have Parliament introduce itself?
My name is Vera Pinzoto, Member of Parliament and Member of this Committee.
So, Kupayko is my name, and I am a member of this committee, as well as Foreign Affairs and Land and Agriculture.
My name is Johannes Mungula, member of the committee, member of the parliament. Thank you.
My name is Honorable Stephen Mwachi, member of this committee.
Honorable Daniels, CC Defense Secretary.
Gerard Koornhof, ANC member of this committee.
Namsu Diale, member of this committee.
Dokas Seagimo, member of this committee.
Faisal Mintuli, CC on defense.
Hendrik Schmidt, member of the committee.
Yes.
John Delange from Beeld Newspaper.
Okay.
CMD.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think we're going to experience technical problems here because I'm told that the note will say that an IP person is all this way. So I don't know too well. I'm sure that we only have a presentation here, a slight presentation by the Major General House Anderson on the use and support of the reserve force. So that will be the first presentation. Then the second presentation will be on hand. That is the exit mechanism and the user exit mechanism. Unfortunately, we don't have a...
We have got documents ready which we can distribute, Honorable Chairperson, just being cleared by the Honorable Minister.
Oh, okay. So I think you're in the process of having a first presentation together of those documents.
Sure. We don't do in the meantime, for the longer presentation, perhaps we might need the ICO. Isn't yours a shorter one? Maybe we should meet him the shorter one slowly whilst waiting for the IT. And then as soon as the IT is ready, then is it ready?
Not yet. The numbers are very important on the second presentation.
Oh, I see.
But Honourable Minister, if I can make a recommendation for consideration by the Honourable Chair, is we can start the presentation. Everybody did receive their source documents. We just need a copy for the minister. Have you got a spare copy for the minister?
I'm
coming with that, sister.
Oh. Yes, I think we can go on because we are not sure. Because not our. Yeah, the problem is not department's problem, nor. What we can say is that it's a parliament's problem that we don't have an IT person. May we with mediate effect start with the presentation on the use of and support of the reserve force.
Honourable Chairperson, the presenter this morning will be the Chief of Defence Reserves, Major General Roy Anderson. With your permission, can we proceed?
Minister, Chairperson, members of the committee, good morning. The aim of my presentation is to respond to the question that you put to me. So I am to provide the Portfolio Committee on Defence with a progress report on the use of and the support to the reserve force. I might add, and I hope technology will work, last night we added two more slides to update you on the deployments at the hospitals and the schools, so you will have right up-to-date information, which I think you'll find very interesting. Let me start off by saying, Chairperson, since we last appeared before the committee, we have genuinely made significant progress with the reserves, and I'll demonstrate that to you. The content, I'm going to give a bit of a background, then we'll look at what is the role of the reserve force, why do we have a reserve force. Then I'll take the four services and summarise for you the progress made in each of the services. We'll then look at the divisions. I'll touch briefly on support structures and then reach a conclusion. Let's move right to the background. In 2002, the Military Council, as it then was, and now the Military Command Council, created Project Phoenix. And the objective behind Project Phoenix was to revitalize and transform the reserve forces. In 2004, we produced a reserve force strategy. A copy has been handed out this morning. We previously handed it out. It's the document I'm holding up. That is the summarized strategy for the reserve forces. And in 2007, March of this year, we had a reserve force symposium in Pretoria with 200 delegates, including many foreign speakers. And we challenged the strategy again, and I'm pleased to tell you the strategy was reconfirmed in March. And then an important development, the Minister in his budget debate speech this year made the reserve forces one of his five priorities for the year. So that's by way of background. The question that no doubt crosses people's minds, why do we have a reserve force? Now in the update of the Defence Review, or the review of the Defence Review, which is still in draft form, the role was reconfirmed. But let me pause and go through it. The conclusion is that the reserve force should provide the majority of the landward conventional capability. So when you think about tanks, you think about artillery, you think about air defense artillery, the majority of that should be provided by the reserve forces. The regular force will be the first wave, but the actual bulk of the fighting force will be the reserve force. That's the most economic way for South Africa to finance its defense. The second role of the reserve forces is what we're doing right now, which is to supplement peace support operations. Typically, our regular force battalions have three companies. The United Nations OVAT requires four companies. Typically, the fourth company is now provided by the reserve force. And I'll show you the details of the deployments. Hopefully, we'll have some technology to do that just now. And the third issue, of course, is homeland defense, and one can add support to the people, and the deployments over the last week or two, which I will show to you just now as well, demonstrate that role. So those are the three key roles of the reserve force. Now let me move to each of the services in turn. First of all, the Army, which of course is by far the largest part of the conventional reserve. The Army started off by recruiting directly, and 1,629 recruits were trained. Most of those recruits have already been deployed externally in the Congo and Burundi, and have done exceedingly well. Then with the phasing out of the ATR, or the commandos, we've transferred across 3,500 selected troops from the commandos, the fit, the young, and the healthy, and they have been retrained as conventional forces. Naturally, the majority went to the infantry, but some did go to the artillery and the air defense artillery. The third source of building up the strength of the Army has been from the MSDS, and here my presentation is designed to follow up on the presentation last week by General De Witt. As you heard from him last year, of the 200 that left MSDS, 61 joined the reserves. We don't consider that to be a satisfactory figure. We should have captured more out of the 200. And that led us to the conclusion we have more work to do to motivate MSDS members to join the reserve force. At the end of this year, some 2,500 will exit MSDS into the reserves. And then, of course, we have the prospect. And this prospect is very important and exciting for the reserve force. A very much larger intakes into MSDS, which, of course, will follow through in 2 years' time into the reserve force. There is a cabinet memorandum which proposes an intake of 5,000 next year. When I was briefing the minister last week, he indicated to me that there was a wish that this could be increased to 7,500, but we were awaiting the decision. And then the following year, the annual intake will be 10,000. And the majority of those will, of course, flow into the reserve force, although obviously some of them will stay in the core service system in the regular force. What's been very important in our planning, Chairperson, is that we haven't only budgeted for 2 years MSDS. We've budgeted for continuation training, in other words, for 5 years thereafter, when they join the reserve force, that we will have money to train them, and they won't be idle. And, you know, because idle people can do the wrong things. So the idea is the 10,000 will come in for 2 years MSDS, and the majority will then come into the reserve force, and they will do between 12 and 30 days of training every second year. So we are hopeful for the outcome from that cabinet memorandum. Let's look now at the leader group within the Army, and you will recall from previous presentations to the committee, we were worried about representativity because the leader group tended to be older and whiter. Once again, I'm pleased to tell you we're making progress in joining and in developing, I should say, younger black leaders in particular. We've transferred from the regular force retired people 83, of which 24 were former NSS. Then we started officer training at the Army Gymnasium, followed by the schools, core schools such as the School of Armour and the School of Infantry. You can see there in 2005 we produced 29 second lieutenants, 2006, 94, and 2007 the planned intake is 120. This is a full-blown officer's course at the Army Gymnasium, followed by training at the core schools. Similarly, with NCOs, we've trained 40 in 2005, 80 in 2006, and the planned intake for NCOs this year is 100. I now start getting into difficulty without the technology, but let me start with the next complex slide. Let me say that this slide probably typifies, Chairperson, the progress made more clearly than any other slide. You can see if you take the middle column that the army's strength is now 11,375. That is a significant shift on where we were 3 years ago. And you can see that 71% is now black, colored, or Asian. 3 years ago, that was 40%. So there's been a 31% improvement in representativity. So although 11,000 is short of our goal, you can see that the reserve force is becoming a meaningful force now. And we've demonstrated that, as I'll show you just now, over the past few weeks. Obviously, the development of the reserve forces is driven by money. On the next slide, you can see the money spent just on items 10 to 60. In other words, that's mainly the pay. You will recall when we introduced the initial revitalization of the reserve forces with Project Phoenix, every unit was lucky to get 250,000. Now you can see the average per unit last year was 1.5 million rand. So money isn't the challenge. Now that excludes the pre-deployment training cost and the cost of deployments in peace support operations. If we add the total amount together, the amount spent on the reserve force last year was 158 million rand, the bottom figure on that slide. Once again, a very, very significant improvement on the previous figures. Now I'm going to take you into the actual deployments, because the question was how do you use the reserves, and let's go through this table, and I hope the slide will come up because the next two slides aren't in your pack. They're last night's deployments at the school. So let's start with the first two. The infantry only in 2007, if we go across the slide, in Operation Fiber in Burundi, so let me interpret this third row for you. DR stands for Durban Regiment, Durban Light Infantry, and Natal Carbineers put together a composite company, and they were deployed in Burundi until February 07. On Mistral, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, this Rifles and South African Irish put together one company. They completed in April. In Texas, which is borderline control, Kimberley Regiment provided a company. Curriculum in Burundi, Cape Town Highlanders, Cape Town Rifles, and recommend Westlake Proficiency, one company. Then for the swine fever control in KwaZulu-Natal, we had a company from Durban Regiment, Durban Light Infantry, Natal Carbineers. On swine fever in Potchefstroom area, from Recommend de la Rey, we had 52 members. And then in Texas, which is also borderline control, from Durban Light Infantry, we had a company. So you can see very active deployments of infantry. Now, in addition to that, many of the guards at regular force installations are now reserve force guards, and we get a double payback. What happens, for example, at the Army Gymnasium, the artillery formation provides the guards, and then when the guards are off duty, they do training. We move artillery equipment to Heidelberg, and they train in their off times. So we get a double payback. And then in the bottom note there, I've also indicated, as we sit here now, we have one engineer troop deployed in the DRC, and a second one is in training to go to the DRC. So those are the deployments so far. Moving to the next slide is the deployments that we plan for the rest of the year. In Burundi, from 1st City Regiment, one company. In Texas, borderline control from the Transvaal Scottish Company. That company you'll see just now is currently deployed at the hospitals. I'll identify that on the next slide. Mistral in the DRC, the Cape Town Rifles of a company, then borderline control in KZN, Durban Regiment, and borderline control recommend no transport. Those are the planned deployments. If we put that all together, the Reserve Force Infantry will have provided 11 companies for deployment during this year. So you can see we are reaching some form of critical mass. Can I just check, General Kampo, are we abandoning the technology?
From the look of things, we cannot resolve the issue.
Okay, I'll just now. Maybe just a comment to the Honourable Chair. We brought a couple of nice photos along as well, which if the technology allows us later, we can show you some of the deployments, our men and women during deployments, and even where our Honourable Minister paid a visit to them in the expo hall
the environment of the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Burundi during December of 2006.
So we have only just become aware of the difficulties of Parliament, but the Department will intervene with the Treasury to do something about the state of affairs. Thank you.
Anyway, well, what you are missing now, Chairperson, is a picture of three very dynamic young ladies deployed in the Eastern Congo. So it's your loss, I'm afraid. But just to show you, the purpose of putting the pictures is to show you how young and fresh and dynamic they are. Right, I'm now going to move to two slides that aren't in your pack. This is Operation Barker, which is the deployments now for the strike. And let me give you an overview of where we are as of last night. The conventional reserve has provided 12 platoons for deployment, as we are here at the moment. If you work out at approximately...
So what page is that?
It's not in your pack.
No, it's not.
Last night's slide.
Yeah, but we've spent that today, and then two slides. Last night we still with...
the Operation Bata. Bata. B-A-T-A.
Bata, okay.
Okay, so we've got 12 platoons deployed right now at various hospitals. If you work on a total number of 40 in a platoon, that's 480 reservists deployed right now. Let me run through the regiments just to give you a flavor. Transvaal Scottish Johannesburg Regiment, Rand Light Infantry, Regiment Noord Transvaal, Durban Light Infantry, Durban Regiment, Natal Carbineers, Regiment Paul Krier, Witwatersrand Rifles, and Prince Alfred Guard. Then we've got two so-called commando platoons deployed, ATR platoons, and then from the medical battalions, General Matsuke has called up 50 medical orderlies that are serving in the hospitals. So that's what is actually deployed now. But as I say in the commercials, that's not all. There's more to come, should the minister require. We now have 14 additional platoons on standby, comprising 560 members. I'll run through the regiments quickly just to give you a flavor, because these have more of a cap bias. Cape Town Rifles, Cape Town Islanders, Recommend Westlake Provincie, Recommend Delaray, South African Irish, First City, Buffalo Volunteer Rifles, Regiment Piet Retief, Kimberley Regiment, and Regiment Bloemspring. What are we saying? We're saying that 22 units have now provided platoons, either deployed or on standby, and the geographic coverage is good. I think we can honestly say, even though we closed the commandos down, our geographic coverage has been good with what was left in the conventional reserve, and we can conclude that the Army Conventional Reserve can actually deploy.
Chair, if I may inquire, is Mr. Groeneveld, Honorable Groeneveld, excluded from this meeting?
Yeah.
Oh, he is a member.
He's a member.
But was he advised from this meeting?
Always.
if I can move on. The next picture we were going to show you, you've seen, it was on the front page of the Sunday Times.
Because this deployment is very exciting, especially around the commandos. And, Mr. Groeneveld, together with this committee, has been toying with the borderline security for a long time. So if there is this type of deployment, it's very impressive and interesting. And it doesn't just only affect Mr. Groeneveld, it affects all of us, but we think Mr. Groeneveld should come, because tomorrow is going to ask another question to the minister.
I've just been reminded by Mr. Sendell to emphasize that what I've given you is only the reserve force. Clearly, there are far more regulars deployed, so that's not just what we've deployed over this time. The picture that I was going to show you now, Chairperson, was on the front page of the Sunday Times. You saw the troops. I was just going to make a drag, and those were the Transvaal Scottish Reservists at Laratong Hospital. So those were the reservists. And you can see they look pretty, the Afrikaans word is paraat, I think the English word is what, ready. Right, now, just to give you an idea of what the call-ups have been like on the last 3 years, on the next slide I summarize for you the call-ups by year. You can see that in 2004 the Army called up 4,311. Then 4865, then 4638. The average then is 4,605 a year out of the strength of 11,000. Obviously, with 11 companies deploying this year, plus the platoons we're calling up now, that figure will go up significantly this year. So the good news is the majority, or a large portion of the 11,500, will be deployed this year. As to that, the guards and those that are in training on courses, we also have two troops of the Transvaal Horse Artillery training in England with the Royal Artillery at the moment. Add these all together, you can see we really are working very, we really are involving the reserve force. The next slide was going to be a picture of the ceremonial role of the reserve forces. We were going to brag that at the opening of the parliament this year, the majority of the troops were reserve force members. We called up 470 members for the opening of parliament, and the picture was going to be of the Cape Town Highlanders band. Also, the reserves were heavily involved in the Bombata commemoration service last year, the centenary, and at Delver Wood. The next slide was a summary of the program for the closing down of the commandos. It's an old slide, it's not changed. Suffice to say, we're on track. But the point I want to emphasize is, we do not close a commando unit down without coordination and, in fact, request from the police. So we do not leave vacuums. So before a unit is closed down, we must be satisfied that the police can handle the matter. Once the unit is closed down, of course, there is a full audit accounting for all weapons, equipment, etc. We are on program, and the closing down of the commandos is going in a very orderly and structured way. And as you saw earlier on, 3,500 have moved across to join the conventional reserves. Let me summarize on the Army before I move to the other services. What are the challenges? As you've heard from us before, we do seek legislation which will guarantee call-ups in times other than war. Perhaps this last week has brought home to us that the Commander-in-Chief might in fact need that power. At the moment, the Act says we only can call up the reserve and compel them to answer a call-up in the times of war. We would like legislation to change that the Commander-in-Chief can do it in times of need. That legislation has been drafted, it's with the Secretariat, and will be, I understand, part of the package that will come to Parliament during this session. The next challenge is a management challenge. The motivation and absorption of the large MFD intakes. Now, if we are so lucky as to get 5,000 or hopefully 7,500 intake next year, 10,000 the following year, that leaves the reserve force with a challenge to manage these people. First of all, we've got to motivate them. There is a risk that many of them join MSDS with a hope for a full-time career. We now have to say to them, the reserves are waiting for you, welcome back. The way we're going to manage that in the future is to get the reserve force units themselves to get involved in the recruitment, so the recruit will always belong to that unit and feel at home. And this will be done in all provinces, by the way. The minister's insistence that our recruitment is not just done in the urban areas. And then we need to absorb them and manage them. The next thing is job creation. What we've got to be very careful of is that these youngsters spend 2 years getting a good income. They come out. We don't call them up immediately in the reserve force and they're unemployed. That is not a healthy formula. Now, we've put together two initiatives. The biggest one, of course, has to be in the Army, where the Army has now got a team led by Colonel Preller, where I've set them up with the captains of industry and companies such as Eskom, Sasol, Bombella Consortium, which is Marion Roberts, Building Powertrain, and Imperial Holdings, are now taking these people. We are trying to reskill them. For example, of the 61 that we took into the Army last year, many of them are now long-distance truck drivers for Imperial. But of course, we're not discriminating against any company. We want to work with all companies. And our ideal is to have all our reserve force members reskilled with jobs, but with a sympathetic employer who will allow us to use them every year from 12 to 38. And that's the perfect formula. We've got a structure in the Army to do that. There's a full plan. And the Navy's also got a placement agency in the Cape, which I'll come to a little bit later. You can imagine, as we get these big intakes, if we're so lucky, we need the leader group to lead them. We've taken from the regular force, including non-statutory forces. We've produced our own. And, of course, we've got the older white people, such as myself, who are obviously getting near the end of our period of office. Our job is to build these, to grow leaders quickly enough. And that's what we're working on. And then we need to get business behind us. And right at the end, when I talk about Project Shield, which is our marketing campaign, I'll tell you what we're doing about business. Just at the end of the slide, Chairperson, there's a little plot. If you look at the Army's proposed force design, which is still going to be finalized by the Minister, of the total Army, 45% will be regular force, and 55% will be reservists. But if you look at the combat units, the brigades, the conventional brigades, some of them will be 75% reserves, 25% regulars. Why the ratio comes down at the total is of necessity. Regulars need to man the training institutions, that sort of entity. But it's 55 in total. If I may now move off the Army to the Air Force, very briefly, you see there the planned posts. They have 9 reserve squadrons. Let me explain for the members what is a reserve squadron. A reserve squadron is a pilot who typically may have been part of the regular force, but not necessarily, who has his own aircraft. And he joins the reserve squadron and goes through the same training and promotion courses as a regular officer. And there they have close to 235 pilots, and then they have their own conventional reserves of 1,231. Now at the moment, the chief of the Air Force, and therefore the minister and the president, have available to them 148 civilian aircraft. Now those aircraft can be used at any time by the Air Force. Obviously, the Air Force pays for the use, pays for the fuel, but the pilot, of course, gets the experience in the hours. And last year, those pilots received 212 taskings, and you can see that they flew 2,131 hours. Now, those aircraft range from Lear jets to single-engine fighter jets to helicopters. 18 officers were commissioned in the Air Force last year. They appointed 20 candidate officers, and there they're putting a lot of emphasis on representativity. If I may move from the Air Force then to the Navy, as the committee has been informed before, the Reserve Force Navy units were closed down. The previous Chief of the Navy said, I don't want my Reserve Force officers doing administration and drinking beer. I want them deployed. So he closed the units down and transferred all the Reserve Force people to existing units, the frigates and even the submarines. He then opened a Reserve Force management system to manage these Reserve Force members. And let me say that the new Chief of the Navy, was not the new, he's been there for a while, is really motivated towards these reserves, and he's insisting that 25% of the berths on all the ships are Reserve Force berths. The MSDS transfers to the Navy in 2006 was 83, 2007 198. The Navy Reserve at the moment has got a strength of 997, and they, on any one day, 110 members are called up. So about 15% of the strength is called up at any one time. So if you go onto the frigates, the fair chances you will find Reserve Force members. When I went on Mendy the other day, the entire catering operation was done by Reserve Force operation. And I mentioned they now have opened a placement agency in Simonstown. This is an agency that develops relationship with port and shipping related industries, such as Portnet, shipping companies, etc. And they place their MSDS members into jobs in the industry. And you can see there's a reciprocal arrangement. The industry is receiving trained people and then release the same people back for their Reserve Force service. If I could move to General Maseka's area, the SAMs. The current strength of the SAMs Reserve Force element is 1,070. They've been focusing on NSF recruitment. Also, specialist officers, surgeons, etc., that you can't necessarily retain in the regular force, they've been boosting their skills there. And then the University Reserve Training Unit has been opened within SAMS. This is a unit open to third and fourth year medical students. We started off with the University of the Witwatersrand, University of Pretoria, and they did their basic training during university holidays. We obviously work very closely with the faculty to ensure that we don't disrupt their studies. And the first 14 have now finished their basic training and have commenced their officers' formative training. The intake in the next year will be some 30. And we will now widen this beyond the University of the Witwatersrand and the University of Pretoria, though we're just pilot samples. And then the normal battles and bars courses, which are battlefield medical training, have continued for the reserve forces. So I move from the four services, I'd like to move to the divisions. Who uses reserve force members? Probably the most prolific user of reserve forces, percentage terms, is Defence Legal Services. You'll find that many of the legal prosecutors and judges are reserve force officers. And then CMIS on the signal side use a lot of reservists. if I could just pat them on the back, from the first deployment in Burundi, which I think goes back to when, 2004, the field post offices in all our deployments have been consistently manned by reservists. They are typically post office employees or former post office employees who are accredited to handle parcels and registered mail, and they haven't missed a single deployment. The reserves have been totally supported there. Now, the Chaplain General is also using reserves extensively. He's attempting to place a reserve force chaplain at every regular force regiment to relieve the regular force officer when he goes on leave. And many of the chaplains deployed in peace support operations are in fact reserve force chaplains. For example, the chaplain in Kinshasa, Reverend Otto, comes from Rechem and Pitkatif. The military policing agency is building up its reserves, and then director of corporate communications use expert communicators, and General Matanzima in the human resources division is increasingly using his reserve forces. I'm moving towards the second last slide now, Chairperson. The other question I got asked, what are the support structures around the reserves? First of all, let me talk to you about Project Shield, which is administered from my office. If you've seen the adverts that appear in magazines, you might have seen it in Salaborna on FAA, the advert for the reserve force. That's part of Project Shield's activity. We also publish the annual, now biannual publication, the SA Volunteer. Here's a copy here. They have been handed out if people don't have it. And that we distributed 30,000 copies to decision makers. We then put a lot of focus into captains of industry to get them behind the reserves. Let me share with you three simple examples. A couple of weeks back, the Navy took the captains of industry in Port Elizabeth to see on the Mendy. This weekend after next, or on Friday week, I should say, the captains of industry in Cape Town are going to see on one of the frigates. And this is not just a joyride. It includes a lecture on what is the reserve force, and then the paperwork at the end is, does my company support reserves? And the company of which I'm chairman of in Cape Town, the CEO will be there, and he will sign a commitment that we will support the reserve force. So it's a payback. And then on July the 28th, in Gauteng, we're taking the captains of industry and labor to the artillery open day in Potchefstroom, where similarly there will be documentation for the companies to sign committing themselves. It's been important now for SHIELD to not only focus on recruits and captains of industry, we now have to focus our energies on the MSDS members. During their 2 years, we have to convince them that joining the reserve force is a good idea for them. And we've got a new marketing campaign, new brochures, and we're going to visit each one of the regular force battalions with MSDS members to sell reserve forces. I think I've already covered the next initiative within the Army and the Navy in particular to reskill people and to create jobs for them when they finish their MSDS training. My last slide is the conclusion. I think I can honestly say we have made significant progress in the last 3 years. We're not out of the woods yet, but we now have a deployable, semi-viable reserve force which is transforming, and I think we've demonstrated our capabilities over the last week that we can produce on the ground. I do, however, say here that the ongoing success of the reserve force is, however, dependent upon the fetus, the lifeblood, which is a bigger intake into MSDS. We hope the Minister's Cabinet Memorandum will be successful. Then our ability to motivate those MSDS members to commit, the fact that we need budgets to train the people and keep them occupied and keep them at the highest level of readiness when they finish, and then, of course, we need to motivate the employers. And believe it or not, Chairperson, at that point, as I finish my last sentence, the slides have come up. With your permission, can we just flick through to the pictures? Can we just see them? Let's go. All the slides there.
The piece of only.
There we go.
I'm sure that you are attentive.
Yes.
Those ladies are beautiful. Then.
Sure. Okay, move on to the next picture, please. That's the Transvaal Scottish. That's the front page of the Sunday Times on Sunday. You notice they decided not to wear their Scottish berets because they felt they didn't want to be identified, but they're still going to go back and live in their communities. And that's the ceremonial role, that's the Cape Town Islanders at the opening of Parliament. Chairperson, that's my presentation.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Minister, Honourable Members. That is, in short, our presentation on defence reserves. And we are, as top executive of the department, extremely, extremely impressed with the progress we have made with defence reserves over the last year.
Okay.
We are ready for any questions.
Okay, sir. Thank you very much, General. I'm sure that there will be a lot of questions from members here. Do you have anything to say?
Well, Chair, at the beginning I had intended to say something, but modesty makes it difficult for me to speak after such a presentation. Sir. Thank you.
Hmm. The minister was saying to me earlier on, Mohose Khaburuni. We are going to move our horse to the power, Oshabaga Modest. I'm sure that the minister will comment later. And that is the other, that the Honorable Smith, Honorable Koronov, Mayor Nomberg, Daniels, Pamela Daniels, and the other person, you'll have it up, Chief. In that order. Then after Mr. Ntulu will have Mr. Ntulu, and then he didn't raise his hand, so each one has to speak. Because it's a traditional chief, you know that.
Thank you, Chair. And I welcome the presentation of the department of the post, and more in particular, welcome the Minister for having been with us at this committee this morning. Committee Chair, I have two things to check from this report, which are not included here. Hopefully, there will be some response. I would like to know whether within the force there are the women engineers. That's the first question. The second question, I would like to know whether there is the reserve force has its own intelligence, or the fall under the force, military intelligence. I think those are the two questions that I would take first.
Yes, my way of the next person, Satyamuto Kebo.
Thank you, Chair. I think mine is just a question of clarity. I don't know whether I understood well that the bulk of the army is made up of reserves. And if that is the case, just how regularly do the reserves undergo the usual training for combative readiness? The other question is with regard to what was called one of the challenges, that is the collapse in times of need, and this required the legislation. And I was wondering whether this invokes some type of conscription. Where do you draw the line between this type of legislation and conscription? Thank you.
Is that Mr. Koronov? Oh, is it Smith? Yeah, Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, it's certainly an improvement. I'm glad to see. Can I just ask, I think it's important that one has a civil society behind you. And I'm glad to see that there's the Project Shield, if I understand correctly, which is intended to do so. But it's a pity that, you know, we have a deployed force in the current strike action. And I recall having read that article, but I don't recall that the role of this of the reserve forces were depicted as such, which is a, I suppose, a spoiled opportunity. You know, we can't influence what the media writes about, but if we do make use of reserve forces, you know, to indicate as such, because that's a way of getting the civil society behind the role and the existence, the reason for the existence of reserve forces, I would suppose. But could I ask you that two things, and having in mind what Mr. Peko said, there's a very fine line between legislation and compulsory service. But I, having that in mind, isn't there a way of not forcing, but luring, enticing people who do the MFDS into the reserve forces, either by virtue of contractual obligation, you know, forming, including that in their contract that they do X amount of, a reasonable amount of camps, or whatever you call it, deployments, for X number of days. So making it a contractual obligation rather than maybe a legislative obligation. And then secondly, I happen to know about the Australian Defence Force would have a very strong employer backing, and it's an honour in various countries, many countries, to serve in your military defence, in your defence force. Gives them the necessary esteem, and they look sought after. Now, you know, it's they also those people are called up, are protected by law, I think it is, to when they deploy, have to receive the same salary, I think it is. They may not be discriminated against. Is that something similar which we can expect? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kolanoff.
Thank you, Chair. I think we need to congratulate General Anderson for the presentation and the progress made and for the hard work that he has put in together with his division, but also for the support received by the DOD. And of course, it would not have been possible if the minister did not put his signature to it and for his support and making it a priority for the reserve force in the years to come. So I think it's a great team effort, and we thank you for the progress shown and shared with us since the short period of 12 months. Just very quickly and straight to the point questions. The one, we all talk about savings to the DOD and the country of using reserves. Have you made a calculation, for the deployment so far? How much do we save the department and the country by deploying our part-time soldiers, volunteers, instead of using regular force? Number two, the officers training you refer to currently being our young soldiers being trained as officers and non-commissioned officers. Is that also a promotion policy involved in that training? Do we train people to be promoted at later years? I'm asking just to unpack the officer training a little bit. We have 11,500 reserve forces at the moment. Just give us a feeling, where do we move to? If we say the army should be 55% of total and combat 75%, reservists, where do we go from 11,500 to what number in 5 years' time, or in the medium-term expenditure framework, just to get a feel from that? Then when you look at the individual reserve units, I don't see the logistical units. Where do we get the logistical support for units? The platoons being deployed currently, do we support them logistically from the regular force? Do we have logistical support units in the reserve force? And lastly, my last question is whether we allow officers commanding in units to have financial freedom to spend the money that you indicate. You indicate your infantry average, let's talk about average, 1.5 million per annum per unit. I believe that is only item 10 finance, I'm not sure. But my question is whether reserve force officers commanding have financial freedom to use money or to acquire money to run their own units. Thank you.
We can have Honorable Daniels.
presentation. Just to follow up on or start with the officer training, Chair. To follow up what Honorable Gornov was saying. I would like to understand first the officer training, does it apply with the reserves? Because to me, whilst you are doing that, if you have people who have been coming from your regular to the reports, it means they've been maintaining. There will be a maintenance of those officers. Whilst we have that shortage in the regulars, if in the reserves we are then training officers to take them up. I didn't hear anything that says you're taking from the reserves to the regulars. Of course, younger people who would not have managed to go into the MFDs. That's one, Chair. Chair, I heard something saying when the general was presenting pilots, those who have their own aircraft. Are you then excluding women who have their aircraft? That's one. Two, Africans. Who might, of course, we know there's no Africans. If there is, then I don't know. They have their own aircraft. Are you then excluding them in the reserves as pilots? Because then I don't understand. And finally, Chair, on the defense legal services, you see there are a lot of dynamics in the legal services, both in the regular, in defense in general. Africans have their own way of doing things and understanding the legalities. The legalities in the defense don't talk. Not at all, they are not talking to Africans when it comes to legal. What is it that is being done about that? Thank you, Chair.
John Duell, who can help with that, Mr. Lobo? Oh, Mr. Julian, Commission Lobo.
Thanks, Chairperson. Let me also join my colleagues in commending the Ministry of Defense for the presentation through the direct reserve themselves. You know, one question I want to, my comment flows from the very understanding that we also commend, and I'm sure the members of the reserves need to understand that from the Portfolio Committee of Defense, some of us, we do indeed share their time that they dedicate themselves, you know, looking at, you know, when someone has to say, listen, at my spare time, let me on full time do X, Y, Z for my nation. You know, I think that it goes indeed a long way. And I'm also actually motivated by the report that you are looking at the MSDs to indeed strengthen yourselves. Despite the challenges which I'm about to allude to now, that, you know, when you talk to these products, the products of MSDs, they are saying, look, I would like to continue. I've done my 2 years, but the problem is that when I'm there, I've got no, you know, what you alluded on, the problems like the payment, because these guys are still young. Benefits like housing, say, no, but I'm young, but I do deserve a place to stay. That I must be able to keep my bond, or to have my house, you know, medical, health care, and so on and so forth. To me, I saw, Minister, that these are some of the factors that militate against, you know, the good work that you are doing in driving the MSDs group into this reserve force. So, I would like to hear more of an elaboration on how you look at attempting to resolve this matter, because indeed it looks like it's a hurdle. That's the first one. The second one I want to go to is one of the business community, or the community of South Africa General. I think, General Sanders, you'll remember one of the things that you alluded to earlier on, I think it's almost 5 years, during the tenure of the then chairperson, Tandi Modiste, was the possibility of making the South African population, employees, understand that when a collapse comes, then they also they need to show an overshow of support by not tampering with salaries or wages of their employees when they then go on a collapse, so that nothing of their benefits, you know, get kept back with. Be it in a former world, they live the days that you accumulate, and all other benefits, like, for example, if you're injured, then that the same medical aid that your employer is providing with, it will be able to cater for you, or it is the military, what's called, the defense one that will complement that one. But the essence being that it mustn't appear like when you are going on this type of a service, you are actually then on your own. That if that could also be responded to. And the last one is the one that to me, I couldn't hear. You see, the areas of interest, particularly in the Navy, the Navy and the Army, the Air Force. Like my colleague has also asked. You see, that's the area where, to me, I do not see much, you know, of this integration taking place. And remember the question of skills. You know, even if you can say the pilot, when you start excluding there, I know it may not be wittingly, but when the previous disadvantaged group don't get loaded in those very same what you call fields, it creates a problem. Then the end, what you see in the rural areas, you see only a white young man or maid driving a pilot and under the uniform, an aircraft. Then they think that, no, you know, again, that's seen. You don't see that view to say, no, but there is integration. You know, so I'm saying that's one direct thing that he poses a challenge. If we have to redirect our resources so that even they make an impact, I think it should be one of those, so that the picture is not created that we're only going to be good. We bring more LSDs only in the army. You know, they are only good, just good ground soldiers, good just ground soldiers. That's that one. And of course, the last one I want to make is this one of, I think, the withdrawal from the deployments. Where we are pulling out the reserves, it is indeed agreed that it's being done orderly. But in the sense that now, that doesn't happen, you don't just pull out the structures that have been there without really being ready to put the necessary structures being in place. But some pictures have been shown recently on some TV that now look. Some people, they cross somewhere, then this border, you even see the fence there, or the wire is just lying there. Now the picture that, you know, some of us then answer, but, you know, when this was this cross, where were the border post monitoring mechanism? You know, I know it may not be so new, but I'm not talking about the border gate this time, and I'm talking about the border line. You know, mechanism, monitoring mechanism there. Because that's where then this picture was shown and then was said, but where were they actually deployed, people deployed in the area? And I'm sure I'll hold it there for now. Thanks, Chair.
Yes, Honorable, may I first off, before you say something, welcome the chairperson of the portfolio committee. And, you know, the minister was saying to me, I'm about to lose my power. I'm sure that I'm going to be here for a while. Thank you, Chair.
I also need to apologize to the minister. I was invited by the Free State Youth Commission to give him a lecture in the 18th Free State. So I did indicate that I would be late due to flight problem.
Yes. So meaning that the chairperson apologizes to the minister and the department. So the department should say, hey, man, the apology was only given to the minister.
Apologize to members.
To members. Thank you very much. Honorable Ngomo.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson. No, my question is a clarity question, Chairperson. I don't know what slide number is this one, but the revitalization progress of SAAF. You talk about 16 officer commission in 2006 and 29 and 2 candidate officers selected in 2006. Can you unpack that? If I say unpack it, who are these people? Where do they come from? Their background and so on. It will help me a lot. You talk about when you are withdrawing your commandos, you do that in consultation. You use the word in consultation with the police. I don't know. because the minister is here, we'll understand why now people talk about, is that thing working properly? Not because on your part it's not working properly, but it seems as if I have the people who are sitting with me in this safety security, I think it's long overdue to hear about this, because we have never heard it from the SAP side. We always hear it from the army side. Now, I don't know, I want you to explain properly. Who contacts who if the withdrawal will take place in August? Let's say the withdrawal will take place in August. Who starts the ball rolling? Is it the SAPS or is it the army? Because at the end of the day, somebody is pointing a finger to someone's chair. And somebody is pointing, and there is a gap now, there is nobody there. But somebody is saying, no, that was my day to pull out. And the other one say, but you was not told that you are going to pull out of that day. Now I'm trying to say, who coordinated, who contacted who in this manner? Because we always get that problem in between. Thank you very much, Chair.
Honorable Mwanza, then to you, Honorable Tobias.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is just I was going to ask about this command of FDR, the operations that is mentored, whether they do get redeployed in the army in some sort of maybe in reservist or so on, or are they getting retired or so on. The second question, I would have loved to know whether these reservists can operate without the assistance from the regular forces, whether they can be deployed by themselves and then with their own commanders and so on. Last question is that when will you say that this person is deserves to be retired or is not qualified to be in the reservist and so on? Who qualifies, who doesn't qualify? How do you rectify that? How do you show that who's got to be there, who's got not to be there? Thank you.
Thank you. In fact, on the issue of the borderline, maybe I should give a progress report to say that we have consulted with the Chairperson of Safety and Security, and we have extensively discussed this issue. We then made a recommendation that says that not only these two committees should be assisted with this matter, but we need to invite Foreign Affairs and Home Affairs, because some people believe that issues of foreign policy need to be clarified. So I want to make a suggestion to the committee to give me a benefit of doubt to reconsult with the Chairperson of Safety and Security and ensure that we finalize even the oversight visit to the borderline, not necessarily to the border gates, and come back with a reflection that will make recommendations to the ministers involved, so that by the time minister, the government gives us the feedback, it will be at a point where we as committees will have made the recommendations to their concern. So I throw this matter to the team to look at it. Baba Jova, I hope you will have interest in that. Let me see then how do we move forward if it's acceptable in that way.
And I think there was the Home Affairs. The Home Affairs was actually saying that it is actually working on some legislation precisely because there is some MODs around the SADC and around the EU areas in terms of the facilitation of free movement between SADC countries and its citizens. So it means we are going to have more problems in borderline control, and I'm sure that the minister will clarify that. I don't want to, after I have answered the questions, I will be able to also make follow-up questions, because I've noted few. The opportunity is now yours.
Before the team responds to these all these questions, I would like to ask you to excuse me. But maybe before I do that, I'd like to comment on maybe a few of the questions. general ones really. Well, the first thing I'd like to share with the committee is that ideally every citizen of every country is a potential soldier if the country were going to war. And that is probably that explains why in history conscription was introduced. So the question of going to war to defend one's country was not a matter of choice. And that is why, therefore, young all citizens would be called up and trained, and then they would be released in society to return to civilian life, and periodically be called up just to sharpen up their skills, so that if war were to happen, you don't start from scratch to train them. The concept that we adopted in this country, which many countries have moved to since, is that at any given time, we must have a corps of men and women, what you call the regular force, under arms, and ready if a war were to, because war never wants you. When war starts, it just starts. So you must have a corps of people that will immediately move to the front line to hold the fort. When we talk about the reserve force, we're talking about citizens that have also volunteered or that have been taken through training. But because they don't intend to be soldiers every day, you return them to society to lead life like any ordinary citizen, but periodically you call them back to sharpen their skills, and then you return them back to society. Naturally, therefore, now, once you say that it's a voluntary and people will come there by choice, you are not going to have 100% of the citizens being soldiers. The number of your reserves is going to be in a conscription system. The number of your reserves is almost limitless. In a voluntary system such as what we have adopted, your numbers are limited that you can take through this process. I think that is very important that we keep that in mind, that the more we are able to either attract or persuade citizens to undergo military training and then return to civilian life, the more numbers we get like that, the better it is for national defense when the situation of war comes. Of course, if war starts, even this legislation of voluntary will be suspended. In a crisis situation, you suspend that legislation. Parliament will come and say, look, we need to defend the country. We can no longer now depend on the choice. The country is going. So you just tell citizens, you send them in, which is why the Defense Force then, in terms of war, commandeer even your lorry. We can take your lorry and say, look, forget about this code that you are going to deliver. Bring this lorry. We need it to defend the country. That kind of power that the nation gives itself in situations of crisis. So, now the people who are our reserves, because the point I want to come to is a question of this legislation that we are about to bring forward. The people who have already made a choice to be in the armed forces, even though after they finish their training that they go to reserve forces and so on. Now sometimes we need them. But now, if we need them, they say, look, we can only come if we feel like coming, or we can only come if the employer agrees that I go. But it becomes clear that we do need to have
power at least over those ones who have voluntarily joined the armed forces, trained, and are in civilian life, coming in for training, and that when we need them, we mustn't just depend on when they feel like coming. We must, the commander-in-chief must be able to call on them to come and do duty. Now, of course, once we do that, and that's important, we can only do that with people that have originally volunteered and are themselves part of the armed forces. But also, that right that we want given to the commander-in-chief must also go with an obligation on the part of the nation. If we are going to say to somebody who's in the reserve force and is working somewhere, that we want them to come and come now, we must also be obliged to take into account that if that person is working, they can lose their job. We must also take into account that the employer might say, okay, since you are called up, I release you, but I'm not paying you because you're not working for me. The National Defense Force must pay you. So for that period that we have called that person up, we must have an obligation to make sure that their income remains where it is or something like that. So that's why we need Parliament's authorization to be able to can call on the reserve force to come, because if we have that right, we must also have the obligation that goes with that call up. And so that legislation will come. We are in the process of bringing it forward. You can see in these situations right now, people are dying in hospitals because the nurses are not there, and so on. So when we exhaust the regular force, and we have reserve force members who are trained medicals, and so on, we must be able to call them. So that they can come to save the lives of people, because the government must not only afford the workers the right to withhold their labor, it also has the obligation to make sure that the ones who are sick, their right to life is protected. You give the strikers the right to strike, but give the patient the right to be cured, to be attended to, for their life to be protected. Give the strikers the right to strike, but make sure that the right of the children to learn at school, that right is also not tampered with. So the balance that government has to keep between rights and obligations, and the balance between the rights of various interest groups in society, requires that we have some legislation like that, which is why we talk about essential service, which simply cannot be suspended. It's got to be there. Now, so that is the difference, therefore, between conscription and the call-ups that we are talking about in that legislation, is that we will be calling upon people that have already voluntarily become part of the National Defense Force. We will not be calling upon each and every citizen that does not want to serve in the National Defense Force. The first condition is that they should have joined. Chairperson, this issue of the reserve force, I think we must understand what the reserve force, the principle of voluntary is very important in the approach that we are taking in the present time to defense. If Mr. Ndlovu here, when he retires, joins the reserve forces, or better still, let us say he inherits an aeroplane from his uncle or something like that, but he doesn't have an aeroplane business to fly people from Cape Town to Joburg and all of that. So he decides, look, this aeroplane is, you know, it's underutilized if I just fly with it when I'm going to a wedding and come back. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to place it at the disposal of the South African National Defense Force, that they can use it as long as they put petrol in it. They can use it for all kinds of tasks that they may want to use it for. And I, being a reserve, a member of the reserve force, and licensed to fly, since it is my personal property, I don't only volunteer myself, I volunteer my aircraft as well, so that the nation can use it for whatever it wants to use. The whole thing is going to depend on how many people of what racial group make such a contribution. And I know that there are blacks now who own their own aircraft. They may not be that many, not as many as they may be in the white community, but I know that there are some. I don't know whether there are any who have already volunteered in this way. I know many who have volunteered and are members of the reserve force at the present time. Maybe some of them have already volunteered also their aeroplanes and volunteered themselves to be on the reserve force and so on. So the secret of this whole thing, everybody is welcome in the reserve force to volunteer themselves and volunteer their aeroplane. But the reason the individuals insist on flying their own aeroplanes is because the owner of an aircraft will look after it better than somebody for whom it is not used properly. Now, as for the aeroplanes of the National Defense Force, the jet fighters we bought and all of that, anybody, can fly them. But an individual's property, they can say, look, I'm ready to make it available if I fly it. But I can't give it to anybody whom I don't know how they are trained. I don't know if they look after it as well as all that. You can also volunteer your motor cars. Sometimes we need motor cars in the reserve force. So if you volunteer your motor car, and then we can drive this motor car. But you probably will want to drive it yourself, because you don't want somebody to drive your car, because they might have heat humps with it. Yeah, the people. This kind of thing. So that is, I think that orientation is important to keep in mind, to understand that. So nobody is excluded. And I think it is good for members of the committee. As we go around in society, you are leaders in political parties, you are members, leaders in your communities and so on, to encourage others. People that you meet, people you know who have their ability, and some of them even to do that kind of contribution in order to strengthen the national effort will go a long way and be helpful. Chairperson, I do want to at this point therefore to request if my team will continue to deal with the remaining issues and so on with much more efficiency than myself. So I'd like to allow me to excuse myself and then leave the committee in the hands of the team.
Yes, but the concern of members, I'm sure that you are excused. We just want to thank you for being with us. It was very important that you were here, just your presence, even if it was for 2 minutes, because we now feel bigger and better and more empowered. Thank you very much. What do you want to say, Mr. Ntuli? No? Do you want to have an appointment with the minister? Never. That is not for. That's for my luxury. Because we don't have the luxury of time, we have to move faster. We have to move a little bit faster in answering questions. Why is the leader of your delegation, Major General, you are going to answer questions?
And so, Jennifer Rensburg rejoins us. Shall I start, Chairperson? Thank you.
Yes.
I will
allocated amongst the team where I think it's appropriate. First question is, do we have women engineers? In principle, the reserve force follows the same strategy as the regular force, where we have equal opportunity. We strive for a ratio of at least 40% female. How many engineers we have, I couldn't answer off the cuff. I would have to research that. I would imagine that the engineer units do have ladies and females, but I can't answer that question specifically now. If it is required, we can come back with an answer. We can come through the parliamentary secretary to give you an answer to that
question. Not engineers in general, but military engineers.
Military engineers, yes. The question was asked, does the reserve force have its own intelligence system? The answer is no. The reserve force is part of the one force. In other words, we work integrated with the regular force. We do have an intelligence unit for field intelligence which has both regular force and reserve force members. But if the question was, do we have our own intelligence system within the reserve force? Definitely not. There's only one intelligence system commanded by Chief Defense Intelligence. So I've just got up to question number three. Let me hand back to you.
Those were the first two questions. The third question from Honorable Smith was civil society and the role of the reserve force, and specifically towards Project Shield. And the one on legislation, I think the minister covered extensively, so we'll only cover the first one. General Anderson.
If I got the right question, I think we did miss one out, sir, and that was, how often does the reserve force train? The question was, if the reserve force is going to be the bulk of the conventional landward capability, how often will those reserve force members train? The budget is for 30 days a year, every second year, and the idea is in the in-between years, they'll either be deployed or they will be on course, so the officers will do their normal promotion courses. But we are planning 30 days a year training every second year. So, in summary, they will do 2 years training in the MSDS. They will join a reserve force unit, and then they will have the cycle of the 30 days. Let me say that that's in terms of a contract that is signed, just to clarify that. There is a contract that's just been revised, in fact it was revised last week, where an MSDS member or a direct entrant into the reserve force signed a contract between the Department of Defense and the individual. So it's 30 days training. Coming back to Advocate Smith's question about why do we not publicise? Obviously, we didn't take any time last week to try and get publicity because we just wanted to deploy the troops. And let me say, we did pretty darn well. We got those reserve force units deployed in 6 hours, which is pretty good going. Obviously, to take the example that I put up, the Sunday Times reported didn't know if it was a reserve force member or a regular force member. From a security point of view, we've tended not to push the names of the units too much, because bear in mind, those people have to go back to their communities. Ideally, in this type of situation, if time allows, you move people into different geographic areas. So you would take soldiers from Gauteng, put them into Natal for deployment. Here we're asking people to deploy pretty close to where they might live. So we've tended from a security point of view to downplay. But Advocate Smith's comment is quite right. We can still say generically what the reserve forces have come to the party we've delivered. And I think that's something we need to take back sooner as the dust settles, to say there has been a product. You've invested in the reserves and this is the return you've got.
Honourable Chair, we will certainly do that. And as indicated by General Anderson earlier, if you would allow me, the reserve force component, we were explicit about this morning. But we did comply by a cluster of ministers' call to deploy 46 platoons plus 1,200 South African military health service personnel overnight. We got the instruction at 7 o'clock last week, Thursday evening, and at 6 o'clock on Friday morning, we were totally in position.
I think the context of the question was on publicity and popularizing the role of the reserve. These members who are deployed, they should have their identity published. So that was another concern, but maybe because you had a short notice, you couldn't do it very quickly.
I may just complete the answer to that question then. I think the point about making ourselves more attractive to the employers is absolutely right. I think we have work to do there. We started it now with last year's discharge from the MNDS, but I think the point is well made. We need to get closer to business. I have personally briefed the chairpersons and CEOs of the top 40 companies in South Africa, but that's just the start. So I take the point, and we will now work more and more on the employers. How do we lure the recruits? Obviously, we've got the contract, but I do think we're going to get to the stage where maybe we're going to look at things as study grants, bursaries, etc. And we will be putting forward ideas in that area. And then the question was asked, how well protected is a reservist in terms of legislation? The old Moratorium Act is still there. In other words, a creditor may not discriminate against a reservist because the reservist is, say, spending 6 months in Burundi. That act is dated in the sense that it still refers to the citizen force, etc., but I understand it is still absolutely valid. And in law, in the Defence Act, it merely says an employer may not discriminate against the reserve force member if he or she is doing reserve force service. We all know, however, that discrimination can be very subtle. You might not lose your job, but you might not get the next promotion. And there we are studying is Australian legislation, where the Australian seats have got quite far in this area. It's not something we plan to put anything forward this year on, because we just wanted to get that key piece through. But yes, we need to look at this whole employer, family, service persons relationship in a lot more detail now that we're getting a viable reserve force.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Those were the questions from the Honourable Advocate Schmidt. Honourable Dr. Kurunov posed five questions. The first one was savings to the DoD, the calculations, whether they were done. Please, Roy.
Yes, we have done some. Obviously, from a reserve force point of view, we've done it to market ourselves. Depending on where you serve, the reserve forces are between 30 and 50% cheaper. That saving arises because, A, you don't pay the reserve force member when he or she is not called up. B, the reserve force pay scale is the lowest scale, so you don't get increments. C, you don't get medical cover when you're not there. So it is a cheap option. Conversely, there is a cost. The cost comes in is retraining. You can't just take a reservist, other than in a state of an emergency, who hasn't done training for 18 months, and deploy that person in a combat zone. And we are very, very pedantic and thorough. Before we deploy the reservists in the Congo, Burundi, or Sudan, they go through 4 to 6 weeks of retraining at the Army Battle School, or the Combat Training Center, as it now is. But depending on the unit, the saving is between 30 and 50% to the fiscus of using reserves.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The next question was on officers' training, and particularly the training we present at Heidelberg. I can just introduce this answer by stating that we have got a policy in promotion of regulars as well as reserves, and these guys and girls who successfully completed their officer training were already promoted to the next higher rank. But General Anderson can give you the details.
Yes, let me say that a reserve officer and a regular officer does exactly the same course. What we do try and do is to give the reserve officer distance learning opportunities which might be greater. In other words, to do some of the theory electronically from home. But the actual course and the examination is exactly the same. So the lieutenants that we produced last year, regular force, reserve force, wrote the same examination. We then do have a full career path in each of the four services. In other words, you've got to do the same promotion courses to get to the same position. So there is a full career path and structure for promotion courses.
Honourable Chair, the next question was, we have got 11,500 plus minus reserve force members in the South African Army. Where do we move to in numbers?
The United States Army will never tell you how much people they have in the reserve force, you know.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. So I'm relieved from answering that question.
Well, they won't tell you how many they have.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The next question...
I apologize.
Okay, but Colonel, I'm satisfied that We can answer without numbers. That's the principle.
I didn't ask for the numbers. I asked for a concept. Where are we moving to? If you say 55%, 45%, 75%, let's talk then.
We will answer the question in concept. And General Anderson indicated that the Director of Army Reserves, General Comfort, sitting here right in front of me, will answer this question for
you. I will share the basic ideas in the medium term to have one subunit ready in each of the Army Conventional Reserve Force units. What I mean by a subunit leader group, including everything. We only started in 2002. At that point in time, most of the Army Conventional Reserve units were below critical mass. So we had to first of all start with the leader group, and now we're starting to rebuild the subunits within those units.
Hello, can I just have a follow-up? Let's talk about units. The unit currently I can work out, it's public knowledge, 380 in infantry per unit. Reserve Force unit. Where are we moving to? Are we going to keep the same numbers? Are we going to expand the units? Are we going to...
Maybe I can answer that question, Honorable Chair. In our defense update and defense review 2006, which will be presented shortly to this committee after the minister has released it, we will give you the absolute details of that, but we are increasing in the Reserve Force components in general. Yes.
I process.
Honourable Chair, may I continue? The next question is on the reserve units, whether they do have block units and are they supported by the regular force at this moment in time. 2 years ago, the Military Command Council made the principal decision to move the support units, logistics, technical services, etc., from the LOC division back to the South African Army. So the Army is busy revitalizing those units to be an integral part of their Army system. But the current deployments, the Reserve Force units rely on the current logistical system. And this logistical system is not necessarily staffed only by regular forces, also by reserve forces, in an integrated approach, as well as PSAT members from our Department of Defense, civilian members. So currently, the current deployments, they rely on the logistical system, but logistical units, specific maintenance units and technical services units, 2 years ago, the decision was taken to move them back to the Army, and the Army is now, in this moment in time, in their force design and their planning, revitalizing these units. The final question from the Honorable Dr. Quirnos was whether commanding officers will have financial freedom to spend their budgets, and General Anderson will comment on that.
The answer is, within the budget, they have freedom. Each unit has to produce a business plan and a budget before the year end. That then gets approved by the GOC of the formation and then eventually by the Chief of the Army. And within that plan, they can spend. They cannot deviate from the plan without approval from higher authority. So, yes, they do have flexibility, but only within the parameters of the business plan. And, of course, the PFMA is top of the mind for everybody because we've got to comply with the legislation.
Honourable Chair, the next question was from the Honourable McDaniels. The first one was on officers' training. Does it apply within the reserves? I think I did explain part of it already, but the one question outstanding is whether we move officers from the reserves to the regulars. That can happen, Honourable Member. But it is, again, as the Minister indicated earlier, this is a voluntary approach. A member must apply for a position. We cannot force somebody into that position. So it's a voluntary approach.
Yeah, but before you continue on that one, I think that the part that many members will be interested in, there should be a creative way for encouraging them to be part of the regular force. So that we do not shorten the lifespan of the regular force even when people age, when we rejuvenate. So that the reserve force itself must not feel stagnant in terms of its I think we need some element of creativity on that part. But what would be interesting, we would want to see in numbers how many joins the regular force. We might not get that answer today, but I think we'll want to look at the pattern of joining the regular force. Thank you, Chairman.
Honourable Chair, we won't have that answer today, but General Dries de Wit is here right in front of me, will provide us with that answer, and we will provide the Honourable Chair Lady as soon as possible with the appropriate answer to that question. The next question was the question of pilots with their own aircraft. I think the Honourable Minister dealt with that point in his replique as well. Defence Legal Services. The Honourable Daniels indicated that Africans have their own way to look at these things, and very specifically the legal division. We recruit heavily at this moment in time to get more and more Africans into these positions. Currently, the Chief of Defence Legal Services, Brigadier Major General Bailey Morning, and we have got a representativity challenge still in the legal division. But in the reserve force component of the legal division, we have got a very good representativity of the demographics of our country, which is currently in place in the reserve force component of our legal division. The Honourable Mr. Natuli asked the question on benefits, housing, healthcare, elaborate how we can handle these issues. I think General Anderson did address it in a previous question by stating it that we must look into study loans, grants, and that the current Defence Reserve Board is looking into alternatives to make suggestions to the department what means we can use to make it more attractive for the young men and young women to join the reserve and to be active members. But General Anderson can elaborate on that question.
I believe that this, Chairperson, is going to come down to a budgetary issue. Providing housing for a reserve force member is going to be challenging. I think if the person was a former non-statutory force member, I think there's provision for that. But I think for the youngsters of today, I think we'd be hard pushed to create the expectation of housing. But things such as skills development, the end of MSDS training, job creation in the reserve forces, and bursaries and study grants, is certainly something we should be looking at. But housing, I think, might be a bridge too far from a cost point of view. I don't think the state can afford that.
I think when you're explaining the cost effectiveness of a reserve as compared to a regular, you did well in explaining that. And I don't think housing would be one of the issues, really. Because if you for a temporary setting in an institution to kind of an allowance as far as housing. I'm just making an example with, I don't want to raise this one, it's more controversial because it's parliament. Let's not raise it. Proceed.
Honourable Chair, the next question from the Honourable Mr. Natuli was the business community. How do they stand behind us? What can we do? We did 4 years ago, started off with a big project to involve big business. For that process, we created a structure for support to the National Defence Force. And Mr. Tokyo Sekhwale is currently the chairperson of this committee, interacting between us and big business. His committee members have been appointed by the Chief of the National Defence Force, and we constantly relook and see how we can roll out this process. It is not fully operational yet, but we are working very, very hard with the champions of industry, as General Anderson indicated in his personal capacity, as well as his reserve force capacity. He assists us extensively in making a contribution towards the champions of industry and making them knowledgeable to utilize also our defense force and the reserves in particular for this purpose. The next question from Honorable Mr. Natuli was in specifically the areas of the Navy and the Air Force, whether we really can state integration in that area. So if you get onto one of our ships today
you will see that many of the people which we bring in from the reserve force are really people from previously disadvantaged groupings. To integrate them, that is the 25% slot, which General Anderson indicated earlier, which Admiral Medimo, the Chief of the Navy, insists that it will be in position for every ship and even our submarines. And he is moving forward in a big pace, creating this opportunity to make sure. But I'm going to ask General Anderson to comment further on this.
I think that the question was, are people from previously disadvantaged backgrounds getting opportunities in the Air Force and the Navy Reserve? I can say categorically in the Navy it is no challenge, because the majority of the new intake is coming from MSDS, and MSDS is totally representative. In the Air Force, the Chief of the Air Force has put total emphasis on this. In these reserve air squadrons, we do have black pilots. Even though they don't have their own planes, they have arrangements with owners of planes. And the question was, do we have lady pilots? The answer is yes. I can't give you the exact number, but I know for sure because I flew with a lady pilot only a couple of months ago. So yes, there are ladies in these air reserve squadrons. I can only emphasize, Chairperson, that the Chief of the Air Force, every time he says something, he mentions representativity. So he is pushing this. And when we get down to the breakdown and the next two questions time about officers, this point will come up again, but perhaps let me preempt it. I don't have the exact figures, but of the 16 officers and 29 candidate officers in the reserve force, I would be very surprised if 90% aren't black. And bear in mind also that a lot of them are non-statutory force people. The Air Force is only in the last year appointed as NSFs, whereas the Army, we did it about 4 years ago. The Air Force has now done it in the past year. So I would imagine that the majority of those officers are definitely black, but clearly I don't have the figures with me now.
Thank you, General Anderson. The next question from the Honourable Mr. Natuli was when we pull out our reserves, is it an orderly manner and border crossing is taking place, etc., etc. But immediately following on that, the Honourable Mr. Ndlovu asked the question, you know, how does we exactly do this task? Now, from our policy and planning division, I've got Mr. Nick Sandel, and with your permission, Honourable Chair, I'm going to ask him to comment on this, because this is a policy issue with us and the South African police. Mr. Sandel, please.
Ordinary law is not going to give a civilian to answer defense matters, but because I know you say, you can answer.
How do you deal with policy? You see, the most people deal with policy that are civilians. So please, is Ben Shafer does the very way, turn the thing to what you think.
Chairperson, honorable members, thank you. Under the government program of action to implement the medium-term strategic framework, you'll see that in the justice, crime prevention and security list of objectives on an annual basis, there are two objectives that have been put down by the Lakota. The first one is to transfer borderline control from the fence to the set. That's a clear, it's been running now a number of years. The second one is that of the closing down of the commander units, because they are linked, okay? And so in terms of the borderline control, because of the JCPS responsibility, the JCPS DGs in the cluster manage this thing in an integrated manner. There's a structure in the cluster called the joints. I'm sure you're aware what the joints are, where it's chaired by the SAS and Defence Intelligence and Home Affairs, etc., sits around there, and it's to do with internal operations. In the joints, between the SAS and the SANDF, there's a full plan to migrate to this point by the 31st of March 2009. And so that is happening. Exactly the whole migration is managed there. And linked to that is the closing down of the units. So it is decided and it's implemented against which parts of the borderline are handed over to the SAPs by when.
And only when the SAS is able to say, we can accept the responsibility, does the DOD or the SANDF then give it over. So that's how it's managed. Of course, one must understand that border post control is really SARS, Home Affairs, and those kind of people operating. Whereas the border line is SAS, SANDF. And you might be aware of the initiative to create the Border Control Operating Committee to provide seamless border control. And this whole strategy fits into the seamless border control strategy instructed by Cabinet in the Lahore of June last year. That's July last year. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Well, I think given the timeline of 2009, it means that still of course. But we will have to address issues that are raised. So there's a number of issues that are raised that relates to the borderline. As I said, we will have to follow a particular process. How also this is projected in the news, people showing the borderline, people coming in and out, how people understand issues of foreign policy. We need to clear there. But in relation to timelines, I think they're still within their framework of giving over to. So I hope member will accept that explanation as given, but we will deal with the other issues from the level of the meeting we have to have. Do we agree in principle on that one? Do you agree in principle as to the matter will be followed up from that level? Or do you have follow up questions on the matter?
Sir, you're asking the question I was supposed to ask. You made a follow-up too. So let's proceed, because the issue I think was in the context of there is this influx of
those issues. Let's leave them for consultation. Issues of influx, but let's deal with the principle that the time frame to give over to such has not at large, because it's clear it's up to 2009. So, but we will deal with the issues of influx for and the new policy that has been put in place. That's under discussion.
The issue.
Maybe it will need to come to us for discussion, but we'll deal with those issues. I was suggesting that let's follow the process. I'm suggesting that we will take it up and then we'll bring the matter back as a process to. If we have to go on oversight, we'll decide on this.
No, that is fine. It's fine. We did that in principle, then we will, make a visit as a committee to the borders. Because the concern is that there's been issues raised around borderline control. And all the issues around the commandos, you see, the specific issue is not, you see, the question on commandos was answered, actually. That is an issue between the joints. Jointly between SAPS and the South African National Defense Force. And they are on course in terms of saying, as we remove commandos, we replace them with the SAPS, who will deal with those areas. But the issue is that I'm sure that our benevolence as a country has actually made a lot of people outside the borders to take advantage of the situation. So, that problem may not be a problem which resides with the Department of National Defense and of Defense, and at the same time the staff, South African Police Service. We will have to include in future your home affairs, your foreign affairs, etc. So as we know that if we have to deal with legislation, how do we coin and take that legislation, such that we are on course in making sure that we address the overall concerns of everybody, precisely because every time you worry about immigrants, illegal, then there is an issue by the Human Rights Commission which says xenophobia. So we don't want to be accused of xenophobia, but there is a great concern, you know, by the community, by South Africans, that the amount of immigrants in our country is actually
too much, and we are all concerned about it. So that has nothing to do with xenophobia. And all the plans which you have in mind out of the clusters initiative, I think will be welcomed by all of us. I think let's wind up, because we don't have the luxury of time. When we get into the next presentation, we'll only have 1 hour for discussion. Thanks.
Honourable Chair, there were just 3 questions left, and I will quickly answer them. The answer was, when we close down commandos, can they redeploy in the army? Yes, in our presentation we did indicate that we have moved 3,500 of these men and women already back into other units within the South African Army. Next question, can the reserve force operate within their own right? Yes, with their own command and control, under operational circumstances, they take their own command decisions. They are trained for that, as indicated by General Anderson earlier. And the retirement in the reserves, the current retirement age is 75 years. So you can be quite older than a regular force member if you are still fit and active. And 65. And but medical prescripts still apply. Those were the last 3 questions, Honourable Chair.
Before make a follow-up, do I have to make a follow-up? Then Baba Pongola will be after Dr. Pembo.
I'm not really doing a follow-up on this particular question, but I think that with regard to legislation on call-up in times of need, it is not quite clear whether this legislation will apply only to reservists. I listened to the minister elaborating, but it was not clear whether it is confined to a reservist.
No, personally, as I call it, I don't think it's confined to reservists only. It's actually in a war situation. Obviously, the whole country has to be mobilized into war, and the legislation governing collapse will have to be suspended, such that the president, in his capacity as a commander-in-chief, can suspend the legislation and make improvisation for new war conditions. Is it how I understand it, General?
In times of war, as the Honourable Minister indicated, Honourable Chairperson, that will apply to everybody. But the legislation change which we will bring forward to this committee and for Parliament is in times of need. Today, we have got the strike that we need to keep the hospitals going, we need to keep the schools going. It's not war, it is times of need. And this is the change in legislation which we propose, that the Commander-in-Chief, our Honourable President, will have that right to call up reserves in time of need, and not only, as currently stated, in times of war.
That is understood, Baba Pongola.
I hope we're not going to discuss that legislation now, as it's not before us.
No, we're not. But I just raised in passing to say what measures will be taken to deal with times of need, in times of need. Baba Bungula. Brother Mike, Dr. Pembo, can you help Baba Bungula?
The man here called Henderson.
Henderson.
He could be a singer. Show me your fingers, Mr. Henderson.
Yes, there is a finger here pointing me. Now, I'm a reserve force,
but now I'm busy here. The letter comes, but I fled that big finger and red flag, you know, on that finger. And now I'm needed to be killed now. Please, don't kill. I'm busy here, but I'm a reserve force on Durban. Now that invite me to come to be there Wednesday, that is tomorrow, for the 6 o'clock. I can't make it. Like it or not, I can't make it. Now, please, don't kill. I think Minister of Defense, if you thank me one day, just put his speech here to say it is not easy because I must buy my own ticket to go there. I'm having got even quarter of buying the ticket. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to inform you that after 12, I will leave you for a few minutes because I need to go and address the media or the youth parliament. So I just received that instruction from the speaker.
Okay.
Just for a few minutes to address.
No, that's fine. Members, I'm told that tea and coffee are outside, so you are not going to have a... what do you make?